I also think that when the animal protection movement really started gaining hold in the 70s, I want to say, in the United States at least, I think there was a lot of harm done in the ways that we messaged the connections between humans and marginalized communities and animals. And I think that there's also a dynamic where, and it's a very real dynamic, where communities of color are often struggling for basic rights, basic needs to be met. And so fighting for others is kind of a nice to have.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. This conversation is with Arunesh Burdi. Arunesh is the founder of Encompass, an organization that makes the animal protection movement more racially diverse, more equitable, and more inclusive. Arunesh, thank you so much for being here and for doing this today. I'm really excited to have you on, so thank you.
Of course. Thank you.
I want to go back to before you were even born to start, because I love your parents' story, and I want to talk about it. I love it. So will you talk about them first and kind of how they met and the journey that produced these two incredible sisters?
My parents started dating as teenagers in Karachi, Pakistan. And one of the things that they did as they were falling in love was taking care of stray dogs on the streets. I don't really know where this love for animals came from inside of them. They themselves don't know. But I think there was just something about seeing that suffering that really spoke to them. And they were very much alone in caring for animals on the streets. I think that bonded them together in a very deep way. And they were teenagers. I forget exactly the ages, but they were like 15 and 16. So quite young. Yeah. My dad is my mom's first and only boyfriend. That spirit of just compassion and justice was just very deep inside them. And so my parents immigrated to the United States in 1985. My dad came to get his master's in engineering at the University of Kansas. My mom came shortly thereafter, and they were just enamored with the United States. It was just like the place to be. They just reached it. And one of the things that they really wanted to try to do in raising their future children was they wanted to raise us with vegetarian ideals and that diet and ethic. And my mom is a Montessori teacher, and one of her coworkers, as she was talking to this, the coworker was like, "Well, oh, your child's brain's not going to function properly," and just, you know, all of the like health arguments, which are obviously now very debunked. But my mom and dad kind of believed that. They didn't. This was before the internet, where they could do their own research, and they were like, "Okay, like, we don't want to make things harder on our children." So I didn't grow up with vegetarian or vegan ethics, really, or that diet. It was really when I was presented with the frog dissection project when I was in the seventh grade that I saw this reawakening in my mom.
What did she do in terms of with the frog dissection project?
So there was a PTA, or I don't know, like some parent teacher conferences in the very beginning of the school year, and my biology teacher mentioned that that was going to be happening. And she came home and she told me, "You're not doing this. This is coming up." I had no idea, of course. Like, I was just, you know, like a seventh grader just going through the world. And I was like, okay, I didn't even understand exactly what that meant. So she explained that, you know, there's going to be a frog and the frog is going to be dead, and they're going to be cutting open this once living creature, and this creature deserves to live. It was mainly hearing her description and then also seeing her fight the administration. And this is when I was starting to learn about systems and institutions, and seeing her kind of come back and talk with the principal. And there was no alternative at the time. It was required that we do it. My mom was really just fighting for an alternative more than anything else. So I think it was on us to find the alternative. My mom did most of that. And of course, there are so many amazing computer-based, now it's even better than what I had in 1997, but there's so many technological advances that we were able to make a compelling and convincing case. And of course, by the end, I was sitting in a computer lab doing it while I smelled that formaldehyde, and remember very much that day where I made a commitment to myself to fight for animals for the rest of my life.
How cool. And how cool that your mom.
I know.
It's such a good story. This was the beginning then, the frogs. And then how did you really start getting involved and interested in, you know, expanding?
The vivisection, the animal experimentation issue was really my entry point. And because I became so impassioned around it, I really wanted to take that on. And to me, it was one of these, I think it was one of the first times I saw injustice in a way that just, it really lodged inside me. You know, I'd been to Pakistan many times and I had seen poverty, and we didn't travel a whole lot in the United States, but I'd seen injustice. But there was something about the lack of power, and there was just something about that human, non-human dynamic that coupled with watching my mom, it just really struck a chord. I would do a lot of kind of grassroots activism with my peers. I got a ton of leaflets around animal experimentation and trying to get my friends to stop buying animal tested cosmetics and household products. So in that time, a lot of my peers would say, well, are you even vegetarian? Kind of as a way of being like, I want to dismiss everything you're saying. And I said no. And it was kind of partly that inconsistency that my critics were reflecting back to me, as well as I had two amazing Black Lab Mastiff dogs who were just my everything. And seeing the range of emotions and their capacity for joy and just their totality as living beings, that made me realize of course, this is not just in humans and dogs. Of course, all animals have this range of experiences. And so all of those things kind of together led me to start making dietary changes. And then from there, I started learning more and more about how animals are used in, you know, circuses and fur farms and zoos and just all the ways animals are used and abused in society. Once that started happening, I was just like on fire and just an animal advocate in all the ways. And some of it was that I was in that angry activism stage that I think a lot of, especially like angsty children are yes. going through. But I had some amazing mentors who were elder women in my community. They had started a group called Animal Outreach of Kansas. And so connecting with them and learning about the ways that we can more effectively communicate and coming from a place of compassion and love and education, that very quickly kind of got me on a different journey. So that's a little bit of my path.
When all this was happening, did you know this is what you were going to do with your life?
Yeah. I mean, it really was that sitting in the room in the computer lab during that seventh grade dissection project that I was like, I'm doing this the rest of my life. I like made a commitment right then and there.
That's incredible. Yeah. Wow. Because a lot of your work up before on Compass was with experimentation.
That's right.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
And talk about that. What were you doing? And you were doing it for a long time.
Yeah. So that working on animal experimentation issues was really my entry point, but also my core focus for most of my years doing activism. I was at the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine for a little over 7 years working on this issue. And one of the things that we were focused on as an organization was looking at toxicity testing and the testing that happens for products, chemical products, household products, pesticides, drugs, all those kinds of things. And there was a bill that was going through the legislature that was looking at toxicity testing and how to reform a very old law from 1976 to make it more modernized and protective for human populations and even the environment to some degree. I was working with my colleagues and kind of became a lobbyist through necessity. Yes. And was working with members of Congress and other scientists and the EPA to include language that requires alternatives to animal experimentation if they were available. And what we were really trying to get in there was language that said, if a non-animal test exists, it must be used before an animal is used or killed. It just, to me, it seems so basic, like, of course, why not? But it was a very big fight and there were a lot of ups and downs. And so I guess, long story short, we ended up successfully getting that language in the now law. I was invited by President Obama's White House to watch him sign that bill into law. And I actually have a framed photo of it with his signature on my wall just to, you know, remind me, because it was one of the highlights of my career in law.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
And since it's passed, has there been a huge difference in terms of testing?
Yeah. So I left PCRM shortly after the bill signing. This is a very long-term process, decades, yeah. But I have been keeping up a little bit with the news of it. It does seem like there's a task force focused exclusively on alternatives, which is one of the things that we were trying to get in, and EPA has a plan. So from my vantage point, things are moving forward. Of course, we would need to ask the experts how they feel, but we predict that over the course of, you know, decades, this will save hundreds of millions of animals from extremely yeah. painful experiments in which they get absolutely no pain relief.
It's astonishing how much we still do too. And it's so unnecessary, so much. So this is a long period of your life that you're working on this. When did it happen that you looked around and said, wait a minute, this whole movement has so little diversity in it and I need to change that? Because that's a huge shift.
I was in the grassroots sector of the animal movement for about 13 years. I did a number of things. I co-organized the Grassroots Animal Rights Conference in New York City in 2005. Of course, I worked professionally at PCRM. And throughout that time, it was always something I noticed, that I was one of the only people of color in the room when animals were being discussed. And I think partly because of my upbringing, being light-skinned, I was quite comfortable in those spaces. It wasn't a situation where I was really actively fighting to be there, but I always had this feeling of I don't totally belong. And there were comments that were made along the way that reinforced that. Why are you here? Why do you care about this? In ways, those kind of small questions that I fairly certain my white colleagues didn't get. So there was this sense of belonging that I was kind of constantly searching for. And so coupled with this observation that I'd consistently been making, and with racial awareness becoming more and more front and center, and this was again in 2016-17, it felt like it was time to really go in and try to affect change in our movement. I was having conversations with a lot of leaders across the animal movement, and because I've been around, I was fortunate to have those personal relationships. I could have candid conversations with people who would say, well, I really care about this. I just don't know how to talk about it. And because I don't talk about it because I have fear that I'm going to say the wrong thing. I don't know if I should say Black or African American, like, you know, lots of questions that prevent the conversation from happening. And I realized that something I really wanted to do and contribute to the movement was identify those gaps and try to create more space to make our movement bigger. And so I decided to take this very precarious leap in starting Encompass, a nonprofit that I had no experience starting a nonprofit. I definitely did not realize all the things that were going to be required of me in doing this, but I'm really glad I did. That's a little bit of how I got here.
Was there resistance, like, within the movement when you started, of people saying, why are you bringing other issues into something that needs so much focus, or that kind of thing?
Yeah, it was something that I was anticipating getting more of. But to be honest, I really didn't get a lot of those questions. I think in certain spaces, those conversations were happening. And I saw other people taking the reins for me and explaining that, which was really nice. Yeah. I just had a lot of allies, is I guess what I'm trying to say there. I was honestly bracing for more than what we got. And I think, especially with what we see, what we're seeing now just in society, I think it's becoming more and more clear to the animal movement that we need to be having these conversations. And if we don't, we actually risk losing our relevancy as a cause.
Tell me about the lack of diversity, why it is such a white movement, and what it's like, what happened there?
This is one of the questions that almost everyone asks, and I have some hypotheses, but this is actually something we're going to be looking at more concertedly. We're going to be starting a research paper soon to look at a little bit of the historical context, how we got here, with very specific recommendations for the movement going forward. First of all, I always say that communities of color have eaten plant-based all over the world for centuries, millennia. It's just that we often don't give them the recognition that they deserve. And then also with colonization, those diets tend to start reflecting the Western standard American diet. There are a lot of advocates across the country talking, and the world, talking about going back to how we, whatever the community is, ate. And a lot of Latinx communities have this, a lot of Caribbean communities have this historical plant-based diet. We are always trying to recenter and remind folks that the way it is now is not the way it always has been. I also think that when the animal protection movement really started gaining hold in the 70s, I want to say, in the United States at least, I think there was a lot of harm done in the ways that we message the connections between humans and marginalized communities and animals. And I think that there's also a dynamic where, and it's a very real dynamic, where communities of color are often struggling for basic rights, basic needs to be met. And so fighting for others is kind of a nice to have. Yeah. And I think that that's real. And that's not, this, of course, I'm speaking in very broad strokes here, but
sure. All
of these things kind of have conflated to create this dynamic where I did an informal analysis in 2017 and found that our movement, the most well-funded groups, have only about 11% people of color on staff and 8% in leadership roles. Whereas the state of society reflects around 38 to 40% people of color in the United States. So there's a very big discrepancy between even the reflection of our movement as a contrast with the United States. So this is another reason why I decided to start Encompass, because I think we have a long way to go.
How did you start? What was your plan from the beginning? And hey, I want this movement to change. But
yeah,
it's a big ask. It's a big undertaking.
Yeah, definitely. So I left my job before this group even had a name. I started with just listening tour. I was trying to hear voices all over the movement, grassroots, professional, advocates of color, white folks, leaders, people who were newer. I probably had, I don't even know, 40, 50 conversations with people just to get a sense of if they view the movement similarly to me, and if they view this problem similarly to me, and if they think that there is space to try to create change. And it was pretty unanimous, which was quite surprising to me. There were some differences, but I would say 80 to 90% of the people I talked to shared this point of view that yes, this is a problem and yes, we need to change it. I don't know how, this is what everyone would say. I don't know how, but let's try. I was just reading and consuming like every bit of information I possibly could. And I devised kind of a starting point. I decided to create two kind of core programs, one working to support people of color directly and one working to support predominantly white-run and led organizations, understand why racial diversity, equity, inclusion matters and how they should bring it in. So then with that, I kind of broke it down a little further and I realized that what the advocates of color are saying they need are community, feeling less alone, some kind of leadership skills training and personal resiliency, support, and mentorship. And then on the organizational side, I was hearing a need for how do we have these conversations? What are the informal and formal practices and the nonverbal ways in which we're creating inequity? We just need like an audit. We need to understand. We don't know what we don't know. So that's when I decided to create this kind of consulting practice to support organizations and really dive deep into their culture and pull out what are the stumbling blocks, where are organizations doing well, and give them recommendations to create change.
Give some examples of you going into an organization and what's kind of blaring to you and that people aren't seeing because they're so in it.
I think especially with the bigger organizations that we do work with, as those organizations move internationally, we see that there's a desire to basically bring what has worked in the United States and just plop it in another organization and another country. And right. That doesn't work. And more advocates in different countries are saying this doesn't apply. Even the term people of color doesn't really translate outside the United States very well, which is why we've actually now started using the term people of the global majority to be a little bit more globally inclusive. So there is this sense of we know how to do something, and so we want to empower and create change in other countries, especially other countries where animal consumption is rising astronomically, like China, India, Brazil. Let's try to translate what we've learned here, there. And that is a kind of colonialist, white-centric approach to doing things. And when we shine a light on that, organizations are very open to it. Like, of course, absolutely. But it's just that shining a light that needs to happen. There are a lot of, inside the organizations, there are a lot of ways in which microaggressions or small moments that happen interpersonally with one person or with the department and an individual take root. And it's often unintentional. And so what we try to do is hear what is happening in the organization and again, kind of reflect it back and say, this is actually the impact it has when you say something like this. And then of course, just actual systems and policies. We are starting to do policy audits to, again, reflect back to the organization. This is what you mean, but this is actually how it comes across, or this is how it's being implemented. Those are some of the things that we do with organizations.
That's awesome. And so what's the, I know you've only been doing this for a few years, but a lot of people have jumped on board. And so what's the impact been like so far?
I would say the biggest impact is starting to have greater racial literacy, being more comfortable and understanding that being uncomfortable is a part of the process. I think for a lot of folks, when they think about doing this work, they're like, of course, I don't want to be racist. I want to do the best that I can do, without understanding that it's actually going to be a really uncomfortable process to get there, and that you're going to have to look inside and it's going to be a little bit uncomfortable to realize I may have actually caused harm for many years from before I got to this point where I am now. I need to ask myself the challenging question, especially post George Floyd. Why did George Floyd impact me the way that it did? Why didn't it happen with Trayvon Martin or, you know, all the people in the past who have been murdered and where there have been mass protests? So those introspective questions can be very difficult. And we're trying to, and what I'm starting to see now is, oh, this is actually part of the process. I don't have to feel uncomfortable and then shut down. I'm feeling uncomfortable, and that means I'm doing the work.
And since George Floyd's death, mm-hmm. how has that changed your organization and just everything you're doing?
This summer, in the 3 months, you know, June, July, August, we probably received more requests for support than in the entire 3 years of our existence at all different levels. It's been extremely intense, and I do have a lot of hope. It actually has very much energized me. I do have a feeling inside of me, and I just finished writing an essay on this. It's going to be published next month, on asking that why now question. You know, why now to my colleagues? I'm so happy you're here. Let's do this work together. But let's not let this momentum die. But yeah, I had to have a slow to respond auto response email because I could not keep up with my inbox. It was just like hundreds and hundreds of emails every week.
Is it from organizations mostly or?
Everything. It's from organizations seeking support. We are doing intakes kind of around the clock. It's from advocates of the global majority saying, I actually experienced this thing. Now I feel more empowered to say something about it. Can you help me figure out how to do that? It's been from donors saying, we now really understand the need for your work. How can we support you? Which has been awesome. It's been from members of the media asking for interview, you know, requests and that kind of thing.
The need for you obviously has been there for decades, but the fact that everyone is now really aware of just how essential what you're doing is and how vital it is.
Yeah.
It is really cool.
Yeah. I really do feel so energized. Sometimes this work can be really emotionally laborious, and we at Encompass really try to check in on our emotional reserves and build self-care into a lot of what we do, taking time off whenever we need it, trying to have more reasonable work-life balance with reduced hours at times and all of those things. Even though it's been more intense than ever before, I do feel more energized than ever before.
What have been some of the biggest challenges since you started?
There are a few things, especially in the beginning. There were a lot of moments where I wondered if we would have financial support to continue on. And especially now that we have staff, it's all on me to make sure that they have a regular paycheck. I'm not used to that kind of pressure, but there was also a point where before George Floyd, where I wondered, are organizations really going to take our recommendations? Is it a situation where they want a little bit of a rubber stamp? And are we doing that? And are we actually causing more harm to communities of color by doing this work? That's probably the thing that I have the most fear of, is actually giving substantive changes that will actually create the change we want to see and not just kind of cosmetic changes. I don't think we're doing that, especially because I'm constantly asking myself that question, but it is something that I want to be really mindful of. And I want to make sure that I'm supporting advocates of color and putting them in positions where I'm not causing more harm.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest thing for me.
Talk some about what you're doing with the advocates.
We have a caucus for advocates of the global majority, and it's a caucus. It's a closed space, really, to create space for healing and bonding and intentionality. And so in that space, we now have, I think I just saw yesterday, 130 members from across the globe, which is awesome. I think we have almost 20 countries represented, which is far beyond what I expected when we first launched. We currently have a monthly webinar series where we look at all different kinds of issues, from overcoming imposter syndrome to looking at self-care, like media training 101, how to speak more effectively to your boss, but also to members of the media. So we kind of are working both on the leadership skills training front and the personal resiliency, how to wade through microaggressions and those kinds of things. And then we, of course, have community building opportunities. When COVID hit, we had a number of sessions where it was just, how can we support each other? Let's not feel so alone. We are all here together. When conferences were happening, we had sessions, in-person sessions at every conference in person, which was really special. And we are launching right now, we're starting the process of creating a talent of color database so that people of color can more easily find opportunities for board positions or speaking roles or just job opportunities. So we're hoping to be more of a facilitator in making those connections between opportunities.
Are you finding that there's a lot of people that, you know, are advocates, but they've stayed away or because of this?
Advocates of color, you mean?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've gotten a lot of emails to that effect saying, I pretty much had one foot out the door. I still kind of do, but your caucus is the one thing that kind of keeps me going. One person said that she was basically, she had a position in the movement, left, joined her caucus, attended several, and then learned about an executive director position at a small food justice group that does look at factory farming issues as well as other issues, and is now the executive director of it, which is amazing. You know, this is all her, but we're just so happy to be a part of her process to feel like there is still space for her in this movement. And we don't want her to leave because she has so much to offer.
The animal protection movement is hard. I mean, you're up against such massive, massive hurdles.
Yep.
The winds don't come very often. And it's devastating. You're just seeing and hearing devastating things every day. So if there's something else keeping you out, it'd be so easy to walk away because it's already so hard to be in there in the first place.
Absolutely.
It's one of the things that makes what you're doing so hugely important. But also, like, this movement, if it doesn't change, you know, where does it go?
Exactly. If we don't really start more accurately reflecting the demographics of our country, we are destined to fail. And we can't let that happen. The animals need us to be doing this work. Going back to your point around the challenges, one of my colleagues did a study, a peer-reviewed study on burnout amongst the animal protection advocates. And 100% of the advocates of color interviewed identified racism that they experienced in the movement as a source of their burnout. 100% is a very convincing group of people.
That's just astonishing.
Yeah.
And really depressing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, I think that a lot of this is unintentional. So this is why I feel so optimistic, because of course there's going to be racism. We're never going to eradicate it completely as long as I think humans exist. So we'll always have some kind of injustice. But we are a social movement and we're trying our best to make the world better. And so I think that that's another reason why I feel hopeful for our cause, because a lot of this is just saying the wrong thing or not thinking through something or being centered in a certain way that you're causing harm without meaning to. And those are the people who I feel most excited to work with, because if someone's wanting to change, someone's wanting to be the best that they can be, and all they need are the tools, like, sign me up. I want to help them.
And that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's very few organizations that don't need you. It's awesome. Thank you so much, Arunesh. Everything you're doing is incredible. And like I said, so necessary.
Thank you.
To learn more about Arunesh and Encompass, go to our website. We will have links to everything. It's speciesunite.com. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you have a spare minute and could do us a favor, please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps people find the show. If you would like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. We're on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Gabriella Sibilska, and Anna Kallner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.